Welcome to the Times of Israel's daily briefing. Today is Thursday, May 2nd, day 209 of the war with Hamas. Amanda Borshel Dan here with our editor David Horowitz and diplomatic reporter Laser Berman in our Jerusalem office. Thank you both for joining me.
Hey, Amanda.
Good morning.
Antony Blinken was in the region. We will discuss what came out of this, I believe, his eighth or ninth visit since October 7th. We will also hear about the potential hostage deal. All this and more when we're back.
Do you or your clients have a commercial collection matter that's going nowhere? The Sarachuk Law Firm specializes in the most challenging collection matters, whether it is a single matter or a portfolio of cases. They are based in New York with relationships around the world. Sarachuk's proprietary databases and tried and proven methods have earned them an unmatched reputation for success in getting their clients what they're owed. They work on a contingency fee basis, so they're only compensated when they succeed. The Sarachuk Law Team strongly supports Israel. You can reach the Sarachuk team at www.sarachuklawfirm.com. That's S-A-R-A-C-H-E-K lawfirm.com or at 646-403-9775. The proceeding is an attorney advertisement and past results are no guarantee of future performance.
The Hamas terror group was reportedly slated to submit on Thursday, today, an amended proposal to the one crafted by Qatari, Egyptian, and American brokers that we've heard so much about. Laser, where do things stand right now as far as we know?
So as of earlier this week, we're waiting for an answer to come back on Wednesday night. And I want to make clear that that was not a deadline. It wasn't that Israel was going to walk away from talks after that, but that's when we expected Hamas to come back with a formal response to the offer. This was an Israeli/Egyptian offer late last week, which was really far-reaching in terms of the compromises that Israel was willing to make. Israel was basically willing to compromise on everything except, it would seem, ending the war officially and pulling all of its troops out. However, there, you know, I talked to people that are aware of the terms of the proposal, and they seem to be hinting that there could even be some sort of discussion about that at subsequent stages. So the point there is that it was really a far-reaching proposal, went well beyond what I expected Israel to do, and you see that reflected in what some of the world leaders have even said about it. You had Secretary of State Antony Blinken calling it extremely generous. Foreign Secretary David Cameron said something very similar as well. Hamas responded overnight without an official response, but through spokespeople talking to Arab media, said that they see the latest proposal as negative. It doesn't go far enough, specifically on that key demand that it doesn't end the war. And that's what Hamas wants. They see these hostages as their guarantee that they will personally survive this war and that the organization will live to fight another day and will be able to retake control of Gaza Strip. And that is really the only card that they have left to play, but it is certainly an effective card.
David, Antony Blinken was here, as mentioned, and it seemed to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that his tone was much more, I don't know, generous to Israel than it had been in previous visits, including on the issue of humanitarian aid.
Yeah, I think that's right. He had come, as Laser said, having said publicly that what Israel likes to describe as an offer, you know, put together by the mediators was an Israeli offer, and he indeed called it extraordinarily generous. So he plainly wanted to broadcast the notion that Israel was really doing everything it could for a deal. Remember, a deal that in the American eyes is meant to lead to, you know, a short-term truce, greater aid and so on, and set the conditions for sort of protracted calm. So, you know, Blinken was endorsing the Israeli stance. I think he was almost sort of bear-hugging Israel. And so, you know, don't pull back from this. And he also, he went to kibbutz Nir Oz, which was incredibly badly hit by Hamas on October the 7th. That was a demonstration of empathy. It's he's certainly the most senior American official to have been to the scene of an October the 7th horror. he went and oversaw places where aid is being transferred. And yes, I think you're right. He met with the families of dual American citizen hostages. He also came out of his hotel and just spoke impromptu with, I think, relatives and other supporters who were outside, strikingly in a way that Israeli leaders don't. You know, he went and publicly talked to them and said, here's what we're trying to do and we won't stop until this is done, getting your loved ones back. So he was definitely broadcasting empathy and support for Israel's stated positions and unstated positions.
Do you think that the optics of him embracing the hostage families, of going to Nir Oz, are part of the campaign for Joe Biden, who, we must remember, also met with hostage families last week, including 4-year-old Avigal Idan, who was a hostage? Is this a new effort by the United States to broadcast, hey, we are still definitely on Israel's side, despite all the criticism that we've been going through over the past several months?
Look, I think there are lots of factors involved here. There are elements and aspects and realities where America and the administration feel very comfortable and that it's appropriate for them to be as shoulder to shoulder with Israel as they can be. And then there are areas where, as we've seen, there are major differences. There have been major differences the whole time about the nature of Israel's military response in Gaza. There has been criticism from very, very early on about the high numbers of civilian fatalities, a belief not shared, really, I think one would have to say, in the Israeli military, that somehow the army could have done this differently, causing less harm. The insistence in Israel that, you know, we are trying to fight a terrorist army government that places the citizens in harm's way. They are to blame. We are doing our best here. You know, that's certainly not the way it is seen in the United States. So on those kinds of things, there are differences. You know, you saw how incredibly central America was and allies were in helping Israel ensure that a colossal Iranian missile and drone attack did almost no damage. You know, couldn't be more shoulder to shoulder. At the same time, you've heard wariness from the president about continuing to give Israel all the weapons that it needs to fight the war the way it wants to. I'm not sure that this has had a significant actual practical consequence yet, but it's a very different tone on issues like that. And yes, he has an election to win, and he's also grappling, of course, with all the spectacularly horrifying you know, pro-Palestinian is the wrong word in most cases. Anti-Israeli doesn't begin to cover it. You know, anti-Semitic vile protests among people who are filled with hatred and their useful idiot supporters all over American university campuses and spreading elsewhere in the world as well.
We are, of course, awaiting the Hamas response. And this is a situation we've been in several times over the past almost 7 months here. And I just wonder if you're hearing, Laser, any kind of, I don't know, disgruntlement over the fact that Hamas seems to be holding all the cards yet again.
So I don't think they're holding all the cards, because Israel has one significant card to play, and that's the Rafah card. By all indications, that operation, which would start with the civilian evacuation, not with tanks rolling across the border, but that is ready to go. What is standing in the way of that? It's not Hamas. It's not Hamas's capabilities. Hamas can't stop Israel from going to Rafah. It's the Biden administration right now. That leverage was, I was surprised, it was undermined yet again, even with Blinken saying all these things that were supportive of Israel, putting the blame on Hamas, not only for the hostage deal, but also for the quote-unquote crossfire that civilians in Gaza are caught up in. He once again came out publicly and said, the U.S. still does not support an operation in Rafah. I would think, if I am in Hamas and I hear that, I would say, wow, maybe there's a lot less pressure on me than I thought. Could we actually imagine the Israelis, after this bear hug, doing a Rafah incursion while the U.S. is publicly, within Israel, is saying that we don't support it? I think that was a tactical mistake. But that is the card that Israel has left to play. If you're talking about disgruntlement, and I guess after we'll look up, is that a word or not? We know what it means. A sense that the war has been, the pacing of it, and in fundamental ways, mismanaged. When we had the reserves called up and the countries unified behind the campaign, and there was progress being made, and we were maneuvering and taking Gaza City, and we took Khan Yunis, and somehow all of that has kind of dissipated, and there hasn't been any progress on the ground in a couple of months now. I think there is a real sense within the military and without that there is something fundamentally wrong with the pacing of this campaign and the priorities of the campaign. And the Rafah operation was kind of seen as, don't worry, once we get that going, everything will make sense. But it's unclear to me when and even if that will happen. So I think that's where the real source of concern is. And listen, we knew when Hamas took over 200 hostages that they had, you know, serious advantages in this whole situation. Even if they took, when they took just Gilad Shalit, they had advantages. So it's no surprise that they are in a position of strength, but I think we are in other positions of strength and we have not played them to the full. And I think that puts us where we are in this position of once again waiting for Hamas to decide what it wants to do.
We'll get to a short break.
Shalom, dear listeners. This is Daniil Hartman.
And I'm Yossi Klein Halevi.
Together we host the podcast For Heaven's Sake from the Shalom Hartman Institute.
These have been some of the most challenging days for me personally, for Israel, and for the Jewish people. And one of the ways in which I've gotten through this is that I've found solace and meaning through discussions with my dear friend and study partner, Daniil Hartman.
And I hope that the Times of Israel listeners will join us as we continue to tackle the pressing questions facing the Jewish people here at For Heaven's Sake, which has become the number one Judaism podcast.
Well, Daniil, I'd also like to recommend the Identity Crisis podcast hosted by our colleague and friend Yehuda Kurtzer. It's a series of fantastic conversations with leading figures in Jewish life, thought, and culture.
You know, for decades, the Hartman Institute has been a preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. Now you can access Hartman ideas on these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. We'll be privileged to help guide you through these challenging and even unsettling times.
And we're back. David, where do you see the balance of power right now? Is it with Hamas or is it with Israeli officials, Israeli powers?
I don't have a great deal of disagreement with what Laser was saying in terms of, you know, potential. Israel is very mighty. It has the military capabilities to go into Rafah. It's adamant that it can do so without causing widespread harm to civilians. It's not clear if that is the case, but in terms of military capabilities. But of course, you know, some of the whole framework of everything we're talking about is, you know, is beyond surreal. We are talking about trying to manage diplomacy and reach an agreement with the really monstrous people who massacred 1,200 people in Israel on October the 7th and who seized the hostages. You know, obviously, they're not inclined to release them without maximizing their leverage. That's what people do in negotiations. It's certainly what barbaric terrorist organizations do with their hostages. That's why they took them. And therefore, the notion that we should expect anything other than the most impossible conditions to try and get our loved ones back, I mean, that's an absurdity. You have to expect that whatever they can do to maximize whatever leverage they have mustered, and they seize the hostages for precisely this reason, that's what they're going to do.
And yet our Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, I think pretty much immediately after Blinken's condemnation of a proposed Rafah operation, came out very publicly and said, we will indeed continue. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, we will know when we see whether or not a Rafah operation is carried out. We have had 7 months of grandiose proclamations and significant success in dismantling Hamas. Where the balance between those two ends up will determine the outcome of this war. Netanyahu insists. I mean, he insisted 3 weeks ago that complete victory was a small step away. Well, you know, it's not a step away if you don't take the step. It's not clear that it's a step away at all. You've had endless bluster, not just from Netanyahu, from the defense minister as well. And it has not been matched, but there is some basis for some of it in the fact that there are, you know, four Hamas battalions left in Rafah and some organized fighting capacity apparently in central Gaza, but Hamas is significantly weakened. It has not been dismantled militarily. And therefore, Like I say, there's this gulf between, yeah, we're a step away, we're going to do it, but we haven't done it yet, and everybody is pressuring us not to do it. So these are very significant, you know, days and you know, I don't know, potentially weeks. But we've been saying that actually for months when you think about it.
You mentioned earlier, David, the protests on campuses, and they are still spreading like wildfire, even though Columbia University, the encampment there, ostensibly has been dismantled and the building that was taken over, Hamilton Hall, was vacated by police. We spoke about these protests a week ago, you and I, and I wonder if you have any new conclusions in the past week in light of the fact that they're still ongoing.
Not only are they ongoing, as far as I can tell, we can tell, they're spreading in the United States, they're spreading elsewhere as well. You know, I mentioned to you somebody had spoken of them utilizing the rhetoric of mass murder, and I think that's the point here. These are protests that are aimed ultimately to deny Israel the practical capacity to defend itself, with the calls for divestment and the severing of American ties and so on. They are protests that ultimately would seek to deny the Jewish people a state in which they can live safely. They've gone far beyond that now. They are assaults, in some cases, actual physical assaults on people who happen to be Jewish. And the two things. First of all, we have seen a greater readiness on the part of university authorities to call in law enforcement, like you would when people break the law. But at the same time, I think there's a disconnect and a refusal to read the writing on the placards and hear what is being said, which is incitement and, in some cases, an effort to harm blameless people by virtue of them being from this or that country or this or that religion. I mean, this is unthinkable and should be unthinkable in the free world. It's certainly something that America should be ashamed of. American educators should be asking themselves, how have they produced a generation in which there are so many people? There are some who are filled with hatred and who are doing this very deliberately, but there are some absolute blithering idiots at Ivy League colleges. What have they been taught? I read a very learned essay by an academic in a very well-known newspaper talking about, well, it's a function of how the syllabus has changed. I don't think any of these people are reading anything on their syllabus. I think we can all, you know, work out where they may be getting their information from. It's pretty horrifying. So it's horrifying in terms of practical consequence. It's horrifying in terms of the authorities' incapacity to recognize what's playing out, but it's also really horrifying in terms of the intellect and effort at rigor by students at very, you know, this is a college that you should want to send your children to. I mean, never mind the fact that they want to kill you on the campus. What kind of educational standards do they have?
Those who are interested in hearing more about this issue should please check out our What Matters Now, our weekly podcast, in which I speak with two Jewish student leaders from Columbia University. Laser, just to close with, tell us a little bit about what's happening with Columbia's relationship with Israel.
Yeah, by the way, when I saw that the president of Columbia was breaking ties, I'm thinking, what, Columbia University thinks it should break ties with Israel? By the way, it wouldn't have surprised me either, but sorry.
That would be caving in.
Okay, so now we're moving to Latin American Columbia. I met. Okay, good. So Colombia has been run by right-wing governments very close to America and to Israel historically. For the first time in recent history, it's headed by a leftist president who is kind of this mix of Latin American leftism. Same you have in Bolivia and Brazil, and those countries too have Bolivia cut its ties with Israel in November. Brazil's President Lula got in some trouble when he compared what Israel was doing to the Holocaust, and I don't know if he walked it back, but certainly faced a lot of pushback. In Colombia, Gustavo Petro, the president, has been critical of Israel throughout, using this kind of Holocaust Nazi language. And he had said that his country was going to cut diplomatic ties with Israel. And then yesterday at a May Day rally in the capital in Bogota, said that it would be happening today. Now, Israel's ambassador had already been asked to leave the country. And Foreign Minister Israel Katz fired back on X and said that he's an anti-Semite. He's full of hatred. Historically, ties between Israel and Colombia have been very warm, and this president won't be able to stop that. But as long as this government is in power and the war is going on, it seems like there won't be any turn for the better in ties with this country. I imagine in the future, things will change. We've seen the significant change in Argentina. South American politics is is very different than other places, and it can swing very drastically, including around Israel.
Laser David, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Please check out another installment tomorrow. This episode was produced by the Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode, please drop us an email at podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until tomorrow, shalom. Mm-hmm.